Nebi Samuel is the burial site for the prophet Samuel, according to both Jewish and Muslim traditions. While probably not accurate, an accurate location historically, this particular site in Israel, it is the site where King David would later move the Ark of the Covenant and where King Solomon would consult with the Lord for wisdom, the high place that he would go. In 1 Samuel 8, where we're picking up our study this morning, Samuel is old. And the nation fears for what will happen when he dies. God has given the nation of Israel many years of peace under the godly leadership of Samuel. But as we come to the later years of his life, it seems we're going back to the beginning of the story. It's a sort of deja vu, if you will. Life makes a full circle for the nation of Israel. And in 1 Samuel 8, we learn, first of all, that what goes around comes around. Chapter 8, verses 1 through 3 this morning. And it came about when Samuel was old that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abijah. They were judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. Eli had led the nation for many years, and we start the book of 1 Samuel with the life of Eli. He had led the nation for many years. When his sons took over the leadership of the priesthood anyway, his sons were corrupt and immoral. That's how we started in chapter 1 of this book. Samuel has now led the nation for many, many years. God has given them peace and prosperity, but his sons taking over are corrupt and immoral. What goes around comes around. We see that often in life, don't we? In politics, what goes around comes around between the Democrats and the Republicans and administration after administration. Our economy rises and falls. Our relationships go through cycles of stability and insecurity. The cycles of life show us that if we wait long enough, we often see the beginning again. Hope Solo was the starting goalkeeper for the U.S. women's team in the 2007 World Cup. She enjoyed consecutive shutouts, but Coach Greg Ryan replaced her with Brianna Scurry as the team lost its big semifinal match to Brazil. She was bitter about the benching and she was removed from the team by the coach. But a year later, just this past August in the Olympics, it was Hope Solo in goal as she led the American women to a gold medal over the same Brazilian team. What goes around comes around. Life has a way of cycling, doesn't it? Both the good and the bad. Well, for Samuel, it probably started out as a matter of efficiency. He's getting old. He doesn't have the energy he used to have. He's pragmatic. He was getting old. He needed to serve the people. He could only serve them in a small geographic location. He was limited in his leadership, so he appointed his two sons as judges 50 miles to the south in the region or the town of Beersheba. It seemed a practical thing to do, but his sons were corrupt judges. They didn't follow in their father's ways and in his godly leadership. They took bribes. They perverted justice. The Hebrew actually uses a word that says they were crooked, crooked judges. And Samuel does nothing to correct the problem. Sounds like Eli and his sons all over again, doesn't it? Now we have to remember the history of God's leadership through the judges. While the priesthood was passed on from family to family, generation to generation, judgeship, if you can say it that way, was not in the nation of Israel. The word judge is really a poor translation because the primary role of the judges, and Samuel is the last of all of those judges, the primary role of the judge was not so much in a legal setting, in a courtroom setting. The primary role of a judge in the nation of Israel was that he was a political leader and often a military leader. He led the nation. He made those kinds of executive decisions. He was a ruler. And God managed the nation of Israel. He's been doing it now for probably about 400 years in the land of Israel through a series of judges whom he raised up. God would raise up judges to lead the nation when the people needed that leadership. And that's the way that God led the nation. You can go back to the times of Othniel and Deborah to see that God would endow his leaders, his judges, with special powers, with his spirit to do the work that they needed to do. So God chose each leader to lead the nation. Samuel appears in his old age to be trying to bypass that leadership process. He is clearly bypassing the way that God leads in the nation of Israel through righteousness and justice, because he has set his sons, who are not righteous, not just, up in these leadership positions. And I think so often when we, in our lives, we often like to take charge of God's process, you know. Yeah, we think we can do it better. The process of judges rising and falling, it's been going on now for 400 years in the nation of Israel, leads to a sense of instability and unpredictability for the nation. And in our lives, we don't like unpredictability. We like stability. We like security. We like predictability. So we try to manufacture the security in our lives by controlling the outcomes and managing the processes by which God is then allowed to work, you see. We look around at others in this world and we like what we see, so we try to implement the solutions we see in this world rather than the solutions that God has for us in our lives. We do that on a personal level. So we listen to all the advice and, oh yes, this is the way it works and this is efficient and this is effective. This is how you ought to manage the problem. We do it in our churches too. In recent years, such a strong emphasis on taking the business models of this world and making it the business model of the church. But God doesn't always work that way, you see. It may seem efficient, it may seem wise to everyone else. But the question is it God's solution for us in our situation? The second principle, what we see in this world is what we want for ourselves. It's human nature. Let's pick up with verse 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together. They came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways." Obviously, if they knew it, he must have known that. "Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to, obey the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, they have rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now then, listen to their voice, obey them. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them." The elders come to Samuel in Ramah. They've already arrived, you see, at the solution to the problem. They don't like this process that God is using to lead the nation. They want a king. That's the solution. That's what all the other nations have. That's the way it works. It's good. It's effective. They justify their solution by pointing out that A, Samuel is old. That must have gone over real well. And B, his sons are corrupt. That was the truth. He was old, and his sons were corrupt. Must have hurt Samuel, though. It struck him. deeply to hear these kinds of accusations. And we are told that Samuel found this idea very displeasing. In fact, the Hebrew is much stronger than that. Samuel found this to be an evil idea. An evil idea. He definitely did not like it. So he goes to the Lord in prayer. The interesting thing about the dialogue here is that Samuel obviously expresses his own opinions to God about what the solutions are. He's not shy about doing that, as if God needed help understanding the matter and coming up with the right solution, you know. Samuel is busy identifying what that solution is and why he doesn't like this. He took it personally. It's hard not to take it personally when we're rejected. No one likes to be replaced in life. It hurts to be rejected by someone else. Samuel sees this idea as an effort to replace him, and he feels the sting of personal rejection. Notice that when the accusation is repeated here, there's a phrase left off. What the people say, or what the elders say, is we want a king to judge us like all the other nations, right? But what's repeated in Samuel's dialogue is we want a king to judge us. That's what struck Samuel. That's his job, to judge. Now they want a king to judge us. Samuel focused on the request for a king. God focuses not so much on the request for a king, but on a request for the king like all the other nations. That's the real problem right there. That's the crux of it. It's not so much that they want a king that is wrong. In fact, God has been saying right along he intended for the nation to have a king. In fact, some of the judges, like Samuel himself, function much like a king in terms of their role, in terms of their authority. The problem is that they want a king like all the other nations. And that's what God focuses on. See, in Israel, the judge, the king, the ruler, call him whatever you want, was to be selected by God and to follow all of God's directives. He was sort of a governor under God. The leader would lead as God led him, and only when God led him. The people didn't like that kind of leadership. It seemed too unpredictable and unstable. They never knew what God was going to do next. They couldn't plan on the stability of a royal family and a strong central government and that passed on rulership from generation to generation. The human way of ruling was at least predictable and preferable to them. They wanted the predictability of human rulers rather than the unpredictable rule of God. Now, God surprises Samuel. I think Samuel expected God to agree with him. And God says, no, you do what the people say. What? What? He says, listen to the people. And in fact, it's strong. It's basically obey the people. Who's leading this nation, God? Obey them? Do what they say? He wants Samuel to listen to the voice of the people. This is what they want, so let's give it to them, God says. Then he points out to Samuel, they're really not rejecting you, Samuel. They're rejecting me as their God. They want to do things their way. They want to control the solutions. And when we in our families and when we in our churches adopt that posture, we are not just rejecting some human leader, are we? We're rejecting God's leadership in our lives. That's how we often work. We find God's ways unsettling. The ups and downs of following God make us uncomfortable. So we develop our own solutions to the problems. We want to control the outcomes, so we put our faith in the political systems of government or the economic prosperity of the job that we have. We think that this is security. And folks, it isn't security. No nation, no job, no No human plan can give you or me that kind of security. Jobs come and go. Nations come and go. We want to hang on to the things we have so that we can feel stable and secure in our own solutions rather than risk these things to follow God. God says, that's not my way. My way has risk. The great missionary explorer David Livingstone served in Africa from 1840 until his death in 1873. Robert Lewis and Wayne Cordero tell of an incident from Livingstone's life that illustrates why we need to trust God's solutions, not our own. David Livingstone was eager to travel into the uncharted lands of Central Africa and explore them and preach the gospel. On one occasion, he arrived at the edge of a large territory that was ruled by a tribal chieftain there in Central Africa. And according to the tradition, the chief, he had to wait there, and the chief would come out to meet him there at the edge of the territory. And according to the tradition, the chief would choose any item of Livingstone's personal property for his own. That's the way the system worked. Anything that caught his fancy, he could take it before you entered his property, his territory. Well, Livingstone had only a few possessions with him, but at their encounter, he obediently spread them all out on the ground, his clothes, his books, his watch, and even the goat that he took with him that provided him milk, because David Livingstone had a lot of stomach problems, and so he drank goat milk because he couldn't drink the water in the area there because of his chronic stomach problems. Well, to his dismay, the chief looks them all over and he takes the goat. Takes the goat. And then he gives David Livingstone a stick. A crooked stick, as a matter of fact, like a walking cane. Livingstone was most disappointed. He began to gripe to God about what he viewed as a stupid walking cane, even with its elaborate carvings there. What could it do for him compared to the goat that kept him well? What was God doing? This is your way, God? Then one of the local men explained, that's not a walking stick. It's the king's very own scepter. And with it you will find entrance to every village in our country. The king has honored you greatly. The man was right. God opened Central Africa to Livingstone, and as successive evangelists followed him, wave after wave of conversions occurred. Sometimes, in our disappointment over what we don't have, we fail to appreciate the significance of what God has given us to use for Him. Third principle, what we don't want to hear is what we most need to hear. Verse 10. So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked of him a king. And he said, this will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons, he will place them for himself in his chariots among his horsemen. They will run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands, of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest and make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. And he will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. Talk about taxation. This is taxation without representation for sure. This is Samuel's warning to the people. For the last 11 years, an anti-lawsuit group from Michigan has held the Wacky Warning Label Contest to show the effects of lawsuits on warning labels. We've got warning labels on everything now. I guess we need to be warned to keep children away from fire. Well, a warning sticker on a small tractor took home the top prize in 2007. The warning sticker on the tractor read, "Danger, avoid death." Danger, avoid death. Kevin Sove, a resident of the Detroit suburb of Farmington Hills, submitted the winning label. Another one came from Carrion Jacob and Robbie Turin of Greensburg, Pennsylvania, won second place and a $250 prize. The prizes are better than the rest of it, I guess. They found a label on an iron-on T-shirt transfer that warns, do not iron while wearing shirt. Richard Goodnow of Lancaster, Massachusetts, earned the $100 third place prize for a label on a baby stroller that featured a small storage pouch that warns, do not put child in bag. Sometimes I think, however, that we treat God's warnings in the Bible about the way we look at these things. Seems kind of excessive, over the top. It's not going to happen to us. God warns us about all these things in life, but, it's kind of silly, really. And we just sort of ignore them, like the nation of Israel. But Samuel is faithful here. He doesn't like the task that God has given to him, but he fulfills it, and like a godly leader, he does his job to warn the people, fully knowing that they won't listen to his warning at all. They're not going to pay attention. They've already solved the problem for God. Why would they listen to the warning? Samuel expects that, but he will do his job of warning anyway. And he speaks of a time in the future when the nation will have a king, and what they can expect from that king. And his prophetic forecast doesn't really find fulfillment until the time of King Solomon. Saul and then David will lead the nation. David, of course, will set up the city of David, which was really fairly small. You can see the area. That's actually probably rather generous for the city of David. But it would be David's son Solomon who would greatly expand the role of the central government, as well as develop huge building projects in expanding the city of Jerusalem. The army, the standing army that Solomon would develop, and the building projects of Solomon would place a huge tax burden on the people, as well as military conscription, just as Samuel predicts here. Many years yet in the future, but it will happen. King Solomon not only maintained a large standing army, unlike his father David, but he built the temple and many other public and private buildings in the Jerusalem area. He mined metal. He had huge metal mines. He hewed rock from stone quarries. And all of that required money, but it also required huge amounts of manpower. The people were forced to support an ever-expanding central government. And when Solomon dies, the nation will do what? Know your Israel history? Split in two. Why? Taxation. That's why. Too heavy a burden. Too big a central government. The northern 10 tribes would split off to avoid the control of the central government, and Samuel's prediction would finally come true. But it wasn't God's solution. Up until now, the nation of Israel had functioned, with local governments affiliated with one another through the 12 tribes of Israel. No taxation, no centralized government. Now they want a strong central government. And Samuel is warning them what that central government will eventually do to them. That's the familiar argument down through American history, between local government and a strong central government, and the struggles in our own history and the debates over all of those kinds of things over the years. The more power we invest in the central government, the more intrusive the central government becomes in our personal lives. It's the nature of this process. Same was true for Israel. But they'd put their eggs in that basket. They decided this was the best solution instead of God's solution. And they would eventually face the consequences. Now, just for a moment, it's important to stop and talk about the idea of a king for a minute. Because I find many Christians think that God was opposed to having a king for the nation of Israel. That is simply not the case. God had long planned for a king to rule over his people. In fact, way back in Genesis, he predicted a king from the tribe of Judah, which is, by the way, instructive because the first king of Israel, the people's choice, will come from the tribe of Benjamin, not Judah. God had long planned for that. Moses talked about it 300 years earlier in Deuteronomy chapter 17. I won't take the time to read the passage, but you go back and read it and you will find it is almost identical to the warning that Samuel gives here. Way back in Moses' day, he said, when you get a king, because you want a king like the other nations, then here's the warning. And here's the way a king should operate. Samuel is simply repeating God's warning from back then. See, God wanted a king to rule over the nation of Israel. Ultimately, that king would be whom? The Messiah, Jesus Christ, from the line of David, of course. But humanly, God wanted a king, but he wanted a king who would live and function under God's rules. In fact, in Deuteronomy 17, you will find a series of stipulations about the king and how the king is supposed to set up before himself the law of God, and he is supposed to follow that law, for God is the real king. And if he doesn't, bad things will happen. God intended a king, but not a king like the other nations. God is above government. God's law would govern and guide the king's law. The problem is that the people did not want to follow God's law, so the people would reap the consequences of following their own plans. They wanted a king like the other nations, so God would give them a king like the other nations. When we don't listen to God's warnings, we reap the consequences of our own choices. And not listening to warnings is dangerous. In 2007, in the southern Russia, at least 62 people were killed by a fire that blazed through a home for the elderly because the night watchman did not respond to two and finally a third fire alarm that went off. And by the time he responded and the people that were supposed to help the elderly were not in their places, they were not alert, 62 older people died of smoke inhalation in that fire. Unheeded warnings have dangerous consequences, even more so with God's kinds of warnings, if we're not paying attention to them. But our tendency is to say, it won't happen to me. It's no big deal. God's just getting a little overbearing here. No, God warns for a reason. Fourth principle, what we want is what we get, often as God's punishment. Have you thought of punishment that way? Verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Now, after Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the Lord's hearing, and the Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice and appoint them a king. So Samuel said to the men of Israel, go every man to his city. We tend to think of God's judgment as sort of artificial, I think. God punishes us in a way that, you know, we can recognize as God's punishment. Oh, yes, that's God doing that to me. However, most often, God doesn't do anything special when he punishes us. What does he do? He simply lets the law of cause and effect take shape in our lives. He simply lets the rule of natural consequence become his punishment for our sinful choices. The law of consequence is like the law of gravity. It simply happens. It's a fixed law. It's the way God has set up this universe. It's the Romans 1 principle of life. God simply gives us over to the choices we have made for ourselves. God gives us what we want. We pursue what we want right to our deaths. God says the penalty for sin is death, right? Apart from the intervention of God's grace in our lives, praise God, he intervenes with his grace. But it's not just an artificial death. Death is the natural consequence of following sinful choices. We end up where we have chosen to end up. Hell is not artificial. The second death is not art. It's the natural consequence of the choices that people make in their lives. We end up where we have chosen to end up. It all started with one self-destructive leap. Shepherds eating breakfast outside the town of Givas, Turkey, were surprised to see a lone sheep jump off of a nearby cliff and fall to its death. They were stunned, however, when the rest of the nearly 1,500 sheep in the herd followed, each leaping off the same cliff. When it was all over, the local Aksum newspaper reported that 450 of the sheep perished in a billowy white pile. Those that jumped from the middle and end of the herd were saved as the pile became higher and higher and higher, and they were cushioned. I guess it pays to be last sometimes. The estimated loss to the families of Givas, Turkey, tops $100,000, an extremely significant amount of money in a country where the average person earns about $2,700 annually. "There's nothing we can do, they're all wasted," said Nevzat Bayan, a member of one of the 26 families whose sheep were grazing together in the herd. It's not for nothing that God says that we are like sheep who have gone astray. That's the way it works, isn't it? Right over that cliff, over and over and over again. Let's just go right after them. It's the way the rest of the world works, just like all the other nations. Let's go jump off that cliff. That's the principle that happens when we pursue our sinful choices. We can't blame anybody else for jumping off the cliff. We just followed the next sheep down there. The nation of Israel followed their leaders to their deaths. Of course, the nation will ultimately end up in captivity, first to Assyria, then to Babylon, because sin leads to death. The irony is that the people would not listen to Samuel, right? But God told Samuel to listen to the people. The people would not follow God, so God followed the people and still accomplished his purpose in the end. That's sovereignty, by the way. It does not violate the human responsibility to make decisions. Even when God follows the people, God is still accomplishing his purpose for the people in the end. When we get what we want, we may not want what we get. Have you ever experienced that in life? But God always gets what he plans in the end. The people wanted a king. God gave them the king they wanted. We're going to study it. His name was Saul. God wanted a king, but his choice was David. And in the end, David becomes king. Saul was the people's choice. David was God's choice. Samuel was smart enough to follow God even when God told Samuel to follow the people. Real security comes in our lives when we learn to trust God's nature even when we don't understand His directions. Graham Cook wrote, "God is consistent, but He is also unpredictable. He is consistent in His nature. You always know where you are with God, but you seldom know what He is going to do next. You cannot find security in what God is doing. There is only security in who God is." That's real security. Because in life, you're going to have all kinds of changes and ups and downs, and don't put security in what God is doing or in what you are doing, certainly. The real security comes in trusting who God is and following His ways, His nature, even when we don't understand His ways. April 15 of this year, Barry and Mary Beth Mosier, missionaries in Tanzania for 8 years, climbed aboard a plane bound for Kisangani, Congo, to visit their 24-year-old son, Keith. Along on the flight was their 14-year-old daughter, April, and 3-year-old son, Andrew. The plane crashed during takeoff, plowed its way through a crowded marketplace. When the plane, now engulfed in flames, finally settled on the ground, 14-year-old April rushed to the aid of a man who was trying to tear a hole in the fuselage. Using the Swahili she knew, April and the man eventually created a hole large enough for her to poke through, and others followed. As passengers climbed out of the burning wreckage, the area around the crash site became even more chaotic. Survivors, medical officials. April was immediately rushed off to the hospital. She thought the rest of her family had all died in this fiery plane crash. 25 minutes later, the Mosier family was reunited. Her mom had a few cuts and bruises. Little Andrew had a broken leg, but they were all alive. Boy, God is good. "When we saw each other at the hospital, I can tell you it was a grand reunion," Barry said. "We couldn't believe that our family of four could all escape a plane that was crashed and on fire, but by God's mercy, we did." He added, "We actually came here with the idea of seeing if we could move to the Congo. So it's been kind of a rough introduction to the Congo. I think we'll keep praying about that." Then he said, "We know, however, that the safest place in the world to work is where the Lord wants you to work." Father, Your nature is consistent. Your ways may seem unpredictable to us. Help us to trust in You, and to recognize that our security in life comes from You and from Your nature. And help us to follow Your solutions, not the world's and not ours. In Jesus' name.